Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This place is special.
Get asked all the time, where's your favorite place to take College Game Day? And I say every time, Eugene, Oregon.
Yeah.
This is the best crowd. Honestly, it's 6 in the morning here.
Yeah.
It's dark. Yeah. It's raining. They don't care.
No, they don't.
These fans right here, pound for pound, are as good as any college football fans in the country.
This program is staged to compete and to win championships.
Oregon is going to be in the championship game. Can you believe the magical season this has become?
When we watch this film, does our effort beat theirs?
Here's Bo Nix. Guns it! Touchdown, Oregon!
Been making deposits. Time to cash a check.
Sound at Austin, which is deafening for an Oregon 15-point win. Chip Kelly still does not have a win against his former school, and we say farewell.
Man, it feels great to be a Duck.
Welcome to the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck, with Doug, Andrew, and J-Hop. Here are the guys with the latest scoop.
Hey, we'll get to the episode in a moment. I just wanted to put this in there real quick. We had originally recorded about an extra 15 or 20 minutes of this episode. Unfortunately, due to some internet outages and glitches, the last 15 or 20 minutes that QB and I discussed were lost forever. So that segment was a little bit about Alabama and Nick Saban's retirement and Washington and the effects on the rosters at both Washington and Alabama. And overall, kind of the bigger picture of college football in the landscape of the transfer portal and unlimited transfers and what happens when your coach leaves. Unfortunately, as I said, that segment has been lost. We will have to re-record that again in a future episode, maybe the next one we do next week. But apologize for that. I hope you do enjoy the episode that we have for you today. And if you hear it abruptly kind of just end, now you know why. Thank you for listening. Good evening and welcome back once again to the QB11 show presented by Scoop Duck. I am Doug Scott, joined as always by QB11. Andrew, what's your food order?
I have no idea. I've been staring, I'm so hungry that I'm indecisive. I don't want to cook. I don't know what I want to order. I've just been staring at Uber Eats now for a solid 30 minutes, and it's not helping me. So I don't know. We're just going to record, and whatever happens, happens.
You
might just starve to death.
Yeah, and when we're done recording, I'm going to go get some food. So we'll see what I'm going to end up with either. I have no idea. But I'm glad to be talking to you again today. It's been about a week, but it's been a pretty busy week, QB, since we last spoke. When Dan had released his video that he's staying, we talked about that. I think the Alabama coaching search was still not complete at that time. Obviously, that a lot has happened on the coaching dominoes front. We're going to talk about that later in the show. We're going to talk a little bit about kind of really early look ahead to kind of the Big Ten landscape in 2024 and maybe the national title contenders in 2024. Again, you know, still a lot can change through spring ball and whatnot, but you know, everyone's kind of putting out these early lists. So we'll talk a little bit about that too. And Oregon has two more commits since we last spoke, so we'll talk about them. But first, let's start with a coaching change at Oregon. So Coach Demetrius Martin, meet
as he's affectionately called, is moving on. He's going to take the coach corners or defensive backs at Michigan State with Jonathan Smith, which is, I believe, his alma mater. Is that correct?
I thought he went to UCLA. I'm going to double check that really quick.
I thought I heard that somewhere, so I could be incorrect. But so he's going to move on there. And in light of that, it seems as though Oregon has already, well, I don't think they've announced this, but it's been reported by James Crepia and others that Oregon will be promoting safeties coach and co-defensive coordinator Chris Hampton will still be co-defensive coordinator and will now be defensive backs coach. So he'll kind of oversee the entire back end of the defense. And then they haven't announced officially who will be taking on the 10th assistant on-field role yet, but it sounds like it has been reported again by James and others that Coach Rashad Wadud will be stepping up in the corners room and taking a bigger role with the cornerbacks. He's been a GA there for the last, I think, two seasons, and it's been you see his name a lot when you, if you follow Twitter and you follow recruiting and you follow recruits, you know, a lot of them, you know, shout him out in their recruiting process and elsewhere. So he's been a behind the scenes guy, as a rising star, I think, in the defensive back coaching. So Oregon's gonna retain him and give him a more prominent role. And then as well, Coach Brian Michalowski, who has been on staff as an analyst this past year, coaching primarily with the linebackers, it sounds like will also be taking an increased role in the defense this year. So those are kind of the big staff changes. And QB, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, any impacts you might see on this, on the recruiting trail, on the field, you know, kind of what are your thoughts overall on these changes?
So I was able to confirm while you were talking that Demetrius Martin did in fact play at Michigan State. So that's news to me, but you learn something every day. In terms of how it impacts recruiting, I don't think it does at all. And I actually think that this frees up a spot that allows you to make an aggressive play to retain some really important guys who probably haven't been getting enough credit from Oregon fans. Specifically, Coach Wadud and Coach B. Mike, I know those were the two that were highlighted by Matt Zenitz. My understanding is Coach B. Mike is the one that actually got Martin's on-field role. Although I think that they can do some funky stuff where they designate different guys to do different things so that they can go out on the road recruiting. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Wadud be a coach that's also on the road recruiting. And I would also anticipate that he's going to be getting an on-field coach's salary, despite the fact that he's technically an analyst. But in regards to impact, I mean, Wadud and B. Mike are two of the best recruiters in the country, and they're young guys. And I think that being able to nurture and internally promote that type of talent on your staff, first of all, says a lot about the program as a whole. But two, is a position of luxury to be in, where you lose a guy like Demetrius Martin, who's a very good core coach and a very good recruiter, and there's no drop off. And in fact, I think that what the space that cleared financially for Oregon to promote and pay these two gentlemen is actually going to be a pretty big upgrade for Oregon long term.
Yeah, and I think it speaks, as you said, it speaks to the talent that's not just in the front ranks of the coaching at Oregon, but behind the scenes. We've talked about some of those guys in the past. You know, you kind of have the two categories of the off-field coaches, if you will, the analysts. You have kind of the grizzled veterans like Coach Kavanaugh, who's, you know, helping out with the offensive line, and Coach Terry, and right, doing a great job there. And then you kind of have these young up and comers like Coach B. Mike and Coach Wadud. And I think I've had the good fortune of attending practices a time or two in the past. And when you attend a practice, you really see the amount of people that are involved in the operation of a practice, outside of just the coaches that we all know, right? We know Dan, we know the 10 assistants, but all those analysts, GAs, student assistants, you know, a lot of these people are, a lot of the kids that are, they're just like kids who go to school there, right? And they haul water around, they move, tackling dummies around to set up all these different drills. And these practices are very, very high paced, very complex, very complicated. And there's an entire operation of people that's practically as big as the player base that is involved in that. And along that, I think one of the things you've seen is the stocking of talent in the in some of those ranks in the paid positions, particularly we're talking about, right, with these with some of these guys that are working behind the scenes and they're up and comers. And when you can just internally promote instead of having to go out and do a search and bring someone in who may or may not fit the culture, may or may not fit what you're looking for, right? I mean, that's a luxury to have, and it just shows what an incredible job that Dan and Marshall and the coaching staff have done, kind of stacking the coaching roster as well as the player roster.
I could not agree more. I think that when you look back at like the best staffs of all time, you look at the staffs like that 2015, 2016 Bama staff where like Glenn Schumann and Dan Lanning weren't even full-time assistants on that staff. And what that created was this like internal promotion. And even it might not be for like next year if you lose an assistant, but it might be for 5 years down the road. Like you have Dan leaving that staff, going to Memphis, and then Kirby calling him back to be a linebacker coach a couple of years later, right? And so having talented graduate assistants and analysts and young coaches in these roles ends up producing a roster for sustained success down the road, because if Oregon continues to win at this clip, they're going to lose guys to head coaching jobs and coordinator jobs, and you're going to need to backfill that talent. And so keeping a good active developmental squad of coaches on staff is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think obviously it can keeping Coach Hampton, I think, is another one that's a pretty probably underappreciated aspect, right? I know that it was reported on Twitter as well, and probably by Zenitz or maybe Crepia, that he had been either approached or offered some defensive coordinator jobs around the country. And he chose to stay at Oregon for this increased role. And Hampton, I think, is a big, big part of what's going on in this defense, along with Tosh and Dan, obviously.
Yeah. It was reported by Matt Bennett that he was actually offered the Missouri defensive coordinator job. So not just like, oh, they like approached him and asked if he would be interested, like full on offered him the job. So that says a lot, I think, about what Coach Hampton's meant to the staff. And I think you and I have done a decent job of bringing up like, hey, this guy is more than just like a safeties coach. He's more than just an assistant. And I think that just goes to confirm all of what we've heard is in the impact that he had on the defense. And quite frankly, in a situation where we didn't know if we were going to be able to upgrade, I think we upgraded pretty massively with him. So huge to retain Coach Hampton, be able to give him a promotion in terms of pay and responsibilities. And I think he's a perfect guy to groom Wadud for the future.
Yeah, so obviously look forward to those official announcements coming from the program. There's a lot of backgrounds to contracts have to be signed and stuff like that has to happen. So I'm sure that'll all be coming out, but I don't expect anything. And QB, I would expect this is probably it for coaching changes. I mean, we're pretty late in the coaching cycle now. I respect we're pretty well set, don't you think?
I would anticipate as much, but you just never know. I think this was the only change that I expected even being a possibility this year. I know you'd probably agree with me on that one, because this almost, I mean, being fully transparent and honest, this almost happened a year ago. I think this will be it for coaching changes for Oregon in this cycle.
All right. Well, let's get on to the recruiting trail. And I think we're going to be back with Justin next week. I know he hasn't been on in a while, so we'll be excited to bring him back in next week. And I think we have a more regular cadence planned with Justin going forward as well. So listeners will be excited, hopefully, to hear that we'll get him on more regularly. But we do have some new commitments this week for Oregon. First, Jamari, hopefully I said that right, Caldwell, Jamari. Yeah, there you go. Transfer from Houston. I know Texas was hot after him as well. Defensive lineman, defensive tackle. Tell the fans what they're going to see from Caldwell in an Oregon uniform and in this Oregon defense.
I mean, think of plus Dorless, which is kind of crazy to say because when Dorless left, I didn't think we were going to be upgrading at the position. But truly a big-time player, a draftable player. Kind of an ugly body, if we're going to be really honest. Like, he doesn't have like that lean, long frame, he carries quite a bit of weight through his gut, but then you see him start moving, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, that works. He's got really really elite burst and explosiveness through his upper body. I don't know if he has a wrestling background. I don't know a ton about the kid from his past, but his natural lean and leverage that he plays with is very, very, very good. And he's a plus pass rusher. He had 6.5 sacks last year, a ton of pressures. He's a guy that you can move all over the line. Very rare that you see. I know he stated he's 6'3". I think he's probably closer to 6'1". I know a lot of people have assumed he's a nose tackle, but he's played out as wide as a 7 technique and actually beat Texas's right tackle off the edge for a sack as an edge rusher in that game. But where he's really, really good and where he projects in this defense is playing as a 3 technique on the inside, where he's just a lot to handle for guards because of his quickness, explosiveness, change of direction, and then his power. I mean, he gets really good extension. You watch the offensive tackle or offensive guards shoulder pads when he's playing against them. It's like they get fork lifted up into the air. Really good knockback power, and then the ability to redirect. And he plays with a lot of motor. I think that's that JUCO in him. He just tries to make every play himself. So really impressive talent, a guy that I think is going to be like immediate impact help. He's going to be someone that I think like truly makes a difference for us next year.
Yeah. You know, I don't evaluate players and I'm not going to evaluate Caldwell, but it is interesting hearing what you said. Cause you know, I looked at some clips of him that were put online and some with you. And you turn on the tape and you see him and you're like, oh, he's a 0-1 tech. You know, he's a nose tackle. Great. You know, just by looking at his body. And then you see him line up and you see he's lined up at the 3. He's lined up at the 5. Oh, he's lined up at a 7. And then you see him move and you're like, guy doesn't look like he should be able to move like that. It's weird watching him, but in a good weird.
Yeah, he's got kind of a funky body, but I wasn't kidding. Like he's just good. he just makes plays. He's just super athletic. Like you see him, he gets out, you get him isolated out in space and it's like, oh no, it's big fat guy in space. No, definitely not. Not a big fat guy in space. Like he can legitimately get out and run.
He was out in space and make tackles. Yeah. Sorry. The one clip I saw, he was outside the tackles, basically one-on-one with a running back and he broke down and made the tackle. I'm just like, when do you see that from a guy of that size? It was, I'm not saying that happens every play, but that was a pretty impressive play along with that edge rush too, off the edge on the tackle. So I'm excited to see him. He looks like he plays with just a ton of motor and that's something that he brings here on a consistent down and out basis. And especially in a defense where he's probably going to be rotating and not having to play, you know, every down like that. And that kind of energy and motor, you know, it can be infectious as well.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I think this is a guy that finds his way onto the field really quickly as a starter, replaces Dorlus, and I think he's going to have more sack production because Dorlus is one of those guys where he had to win like immediately with quickness or move, and really he was more of a technician than he was like a true like incredible athlete. And Caldwell doesn't have to win with his initial move. He can get out. And he has a good rush plan, but he can get into his second, third move. He just continues to push the pocket because he's just human leverage. He just plays with such elite lean. He's so strong. And I don't know if he has long arms. I've never seen his measurements, but the way that he gets pressed out on offensive linemen, you would expect that he does. And it's not like he was doing this in a bad league. He was doing this in the Big 12 last year. So I'm really excited about what Caldwell has to offer.
Well, it looked like third time was the charm with that one. I know Oregon went after, obviously, Walter Nolan, and then they went after Harmon, who chose to return to Michigan State, and then now at that interior spot. Again, these guys aren't all necessarily the exact same position, but, you know, they're all interior defensive line, and now they got Caldwell in the third go-round. So good get there. And let's move on to Brandon Johnson. This is an interesting recruitment. So he's a transfer from Duke, played pretty much exclusively in the slot. Nickel last year as a in the coverage for Duke. He's someone that there was some early smoke, if you will, or reports that he might be interested in Oregon or might be coming to Oregon like a month ago when the portal opened in early December, maybe more than a month ago. And then you kind of never really heard anything more about him, about Oregon. Like I didn't hear any reports of him visiting anywhere. I don't even know if he visited Oregon or not, but it was a really quiet month or so. And then all of a sudden out of the blue yesterday, oh, Brandon Johnson commits to Oregon. Like, oh, okay. There's another DB.
Yeah, what about this guy? And He's a nickel. And I know a lot of people like, oh, safety, they're assuming that we're bringing him in to play deep. And that is not the case. He's a nickel safety. There's basically zero film of him playing anything else. So any hopes of him coming in and being the answer at free safety or deep safety, I think that's what Savage is for. But really fast player. Yeah, to me, he's basically Tysheem Johnson. I don't love him playing in reverse. I don't love him playing deep coverage as a post safety. And sometimes he can get beaten man, but like as a downhill defender, first and foremost, he can track across the field. He can run sideline to sideline. He's a really aggressive tackler, which I think is really what you're looking for here is you're looking to get an enforcer, a guy that could run sideline to sideline and provide a veteran leadership in the star room for a guy like Dalen Austin, who's got better natural coverage ability to kind of come up and learn from.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Yeah, you know, and with the move to the Big Ten, I know, you know, there was a lot of focus last year, and rightfully so, on, you know, the deficiencies at that position in coverage, particularly against Washington twice, right, and against some other teams as well. But, you know, with the move to the Big Ten, there's going to be some of those teams that, you know, Ohio State, USC, Washington, maybe, you know, that are going to play that way still, and that you do need to have better speed, better coverage in the back end. But a lot of teams in that conference also that Oregon's going to be playing, you're going to need your nickel to be more of a downhill player, right? Up and run support, up on the line, right? Because they are going to be playing heavier boxes and heavier. And not to say you can't switch out your nickel, but in your base defense, I think you are going to need a more downhill nickel. So maybe that's not the worst thing in the world for Oregon to have options, you know, to go either way depending on the matchups.
Yep, I agree. I think that they're going to look to mix and match. And I think that really what they want is they want to get away from having a super thin lineup like they did a year ago, where you really didn't have, you had three safeties that you played all year, because once Brian Addison was no longer with the team, it was Stevens, Johnson, and Williams. And really beyond that, there was nobody else. And I don't think they want to get caught in that situation, because frankly, Oregon was really fortunate from an injury standpoint to not have to lose one of those guys and get forced into playing someone that's just not ready to go. And so when all of those things considered, I think that adding depth and talent and top end experience to the room was important. And they accomplished that with Johnson. They accomplished that with Savage. They accomplished that with Alexander. And so I think I really believe they love the young crop of players that they have. But did they want to be caught in a position where that's all they had? I don't think that was the case. I think that would have been a bad spot to be caught in. So what are your thoughts, Doug?
No, I think that's exactly it. I think they're clearly, I continue to be surprised in a good way, because I keep thinking like, oh, well, we're deep at this position. We're deep at that position. We don't need any more bodies there. You know, we've got all these recruits we've brought in over the last couple cycles. And then, you know, we go and get another corner and we go and get another nickel. Safety, I obviously agreed with from the start. So what do I know? I don't know as much as the staff knows. And what I know is that this staff knows what they're doing with roster management. They know what they're doing with talent acquisition. And they have way, way, way more information about their plans and their needs than I ever could. So I'm not going to question it. If they think this guy is going to help them, and anybody they bring in, you know, not just Brandon Johnson, but any of these players that they're bringing in, the staff clearly thinks they're bringing them in and they're going to help them next year. And quite honestly, we have two portal seasons now in the books. And I think they were right on 85% of those acquisitions. So I'm not going to question it.
Yeah, I could not agree more. It's like, okay, well, at this point, they've definitely earned my trust. I'm not saying that because they need my trust with Johnson. I'm not seeing like super high end coverage ability with him, but that doesn't mean he can't be a good player for us and give us good snaps. So
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I mean, I just think, you know, what we saw in the back end, particularly in the two safety and nickel position, was we had three guys that were above the line, as Dan says, for the majority of the season that were playing 100% of the snaps. And we've talked about this over and over and over again, right? That is not ideal, both from a, you know, an injury standpoint, but also just from a, you know, even in a game standpoint, right? You have different types of matchups that you want to be able to be flexible for. You have, you know, just giving guys a blow on a series or, you know, a few plays, you know, so that he's fresher, you know, when you need him on key plays or at the end of the game or a key third down or whatever, a scoring opportunity for the other team. And I think if Oregon has six guys that are above the line at those three deep center positions this year, then that's twice as many as they had last year. And that's ultimately a good thing and where you need to be. So,
yeah,
I'm all for it.
Not agree more. I think that what I've seen is Oregon just wanted to have more bodies. Like we play so many guys up front. And we just didn't have the same flexibility to do that in the back half of the defense. And also, like, there was some reports yesterday. There was an Instagram post from Jaleel Florence that he had a surgery. So it's like, when is he going to be back? Is it something that's a longer-term problem? Is it something that that he can get back on the field for the spring with? And so when you start, like, when you hear things like that, it's like, oh, yeah, the staff does know what they're doing. They are operating with substantially more information than we are. And so they probably are putting us in a position to be successful. And that's been true every single year since they've been here. And I think that's true here. And so, again, like, if you're asking me, like, Brandon Johnson's a better player than either Stevens and Tysheem Johnson, probably. And he's fast and he can run sideline to sideline and he's a really good tackler. Like, and there is a role for a guy like that in this defense.
Yeah, I think the more options you have, the better. Like you were saying last week when we brought in Cam Alexander, we talked about him. You know, the more guys that can cover, the better. So, yeah, great. Another great addition there. And obviously, you know, the Jabbar Muhammad continues to be in play as well. He visited Texas this week. He's going to, I think he's at Alabama now for the weekend. And then it's been reported today. Shout out to Max. I forget, Max Torres reported this. He was the first one to report this today, that Jabbar will be visiting Oregon next weekend. So that's another cover guy, true corner, obviously, that Oregon is, I assuming, would absolutely take if he's willing to come here instead of Alabama or Texas. So that's another guy that can cover that could be added to this defensive back room and Coach Hampton and Coach Wadude and, you know, going to have a lot of guys back there, and that's going to be a lot of competition in the spring, which is great.
Yeah, and that's what you want, what you're looking for. You want to have as many guys. I mean, like we talked about multiple times, you can never have too many guys that can cover. And so does it cause somebody to leave? I don't know. I think that with Coach Martin leaving, there's probably at least one player that we could assume is most likely out after the spring, just based on how much he played last year and where he came from. I'm not saying it's 100%. I'm not saying I have any inside information because I don't. I'm just guessing, but just based off of what we know, it seems that if you have an opportunity to upgrade and add more cover guys, you're going to take that.
I mean, there's going to have to be attrition. You know, Oregon's somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 scholarship players right now. Again, we talked about why it's hard to know the exact number between some guys that are walk-ons potentially and all the specialists. But it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 to 92 scholarship players right now. And that doesn't include Jabbar or anybody that might come in the spring. So Yeah, that room, that corner room particularly, is getting quite full, especially if you add Muhammad. So that's it's a spot where you could see some attrition. You know, maybe out of the safety room as well, maybe out of the linebacker room, maybe out of the offensive line room, maybe out of the receiver room. I mean, somewhere across this roster, you're going to find five or seven more guys that head out in the spring portal window. And you know, that's the new normal. Yeah, we talk about this all the time, but it's competition, and the cream rises to the top, and the other guys thankfully have an opportunity with the way the system is now, where they can go transfer to another place that where they can play. So I don't have any problem with that. And Oregon fans shouldn't either.
No, absolutely not. And I think that Bud Elliott on the Cover 3 podcast said it really well today, like he typically does, that really it's the best teams, the best rosters now, because you can't just stack and hoard talent like you could before the transfer portal or NIL. But the best rosters now are going to be the ones that have basically first right of refusal on all the 4- and 5-star players, meaning that they're going to get them on campus and they're going to find out for themselves who the best players are. And they're going to get their first option to keep those guys. And are they always going to be right with that evaluation? Not necessarily. Are they occasionally going to keep the wrong guy? Maybe, but like we've been talking about, like I'm going to, my default position is going to be trusting the staff to make the right decision with those guys. And as long as they're bringing in high quantities of quality talent, it's never going to be a problem.
Absolutely. You want to move on to the next topic?
Sure.
Did you order some food yet?
I did.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that.
We just went with Old Faithful. We just went with some Chipotle. Which, honestly, ordering Chipotle is a risky proposition, because there's a chance when you order Chipotle that you're going to end up just getting completely skimped on the ingredient. So,
yeah, I like to be there when I'm ordering it in person. You know, like, no, give me that. No, I don't want that, you know. All right, let's move on. So, Big Ten. Oregon, as you know, is moving into the Big Ten next year, along with Washington, USC, and UCLA. I don't want to necessarily power rank 18 teams here at QB, but, you know, maybe we can talk about tiers, you know, tiers of teams as we're looking at ahead to next year, and where Oregon, where the other teams fit in to the pecking order in the Big Ten. And I guess let's start with, like, what are the teams that you think can win the Big Ten conference next year?
Ohio State, list? Oregon. Yeah, it's a 4-team list. I think it's a 3-team list, but I'll add a Penn State because there's a chance with the new offensive coordinator that things just go really right for them. But I tend to lean Oregon, Ohio State, Michigan, and Penn State. And I think Penn State's that's probably in the outside looking into that group.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I think that's the clear top four. I know. There's probably going to be some others that would want to be included in there. I think, you know, obviously a team like Washington, I think you and I were expecting to fall off a bit next year anyway, given what the roster was looking like. But obviously now, and we're going to talk about them a little bit more later, they're not even in the conversation. I think USC fans would expect themselves to be in that conversation, but I don't see it yet. I think they've had, you know, they got a new quarterback. They got to figure out that. And then they've got all new defensive staff. They got a lot of new players. I don't think they're quite ready in that tier. I definitely put USC in the second tier though, along with some other teams, but I don't have them in tier one either.
Yeah. To me, it's really kind of a 2-team race. I think Michigan's being a wild card because their defense, they do return just a ridiculous amount of talent. But we don't know yet what's going to be happening with Jim Harbaugh. And that could change things as well in regards to like, what does their talent look like? Because what happens if Harbaugh takes multiple key assistants and then Moore is unable to keep that roster together? Now, I don't think that's something that they're going to end up having to deal with, because I think Sharon Moore is a really good coach. I think that he's got fantastic relationships across that roster. So I think that they'll be able to hold things together. But just with what we've seen out of Washington and Alabama over the last week, it's never safe to assume, I think, at this point. And so you want to make sure you want to make sure that, like, you want to see it before you just ride it in. So to me, if Michigan stays together and keeps that roster in one piece, I think Michigan's absolutely a contender depending on quarterback play. Whereas I feel a lot more confident with the whole roster all the way around with Oregon and Michigan.
Well, the
Ohio State.
Yeah, no, I gotcha. The other interesting thing about that is Michigan, Oregon, Ohio State all play each other. So where that could come into play is with the top two format, right? Your scheduling could determine one of the participants in, you know, could be a bigger factor in determining one of the participants in the Big Ten title game, right? So if those three teams all have to play both of the other two, you know, there's losses in there, right? Versus maybe somebody who only has to play one of those three or two of those three has a better chance to sneak into the Big Ten title game. Now, I think that team would be, you know, significantly overmatched and wouldn't really have a good chance of winning the Big Ten title game. But I do think there's a scenario at play where the best two teams aren't necessarily playing in the Big Ten title game just because of the round robin scheduling at the top.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, a team like Penn State could show up though in late December, in December, early December, and beat a Michigan or Ohio State and Oregon if they get hot at the right time and their schedule breaks the right way. Whereas a team that plays the other two in a round robin format, like Oregon, Washington, Ohio State have to do, could win one or both of those games and then choke the ability to get the bye week in the playoffs. So it's interesting because it's not an elimination game from playoff consideration like it might have been in years past. It'll instead be like, all right, you're playing for that bye week, which I think is going to end up being a lot more important than people are talking about right now, because four more games at the end of the season in a 12-team playoff, it's gonna be tough to stay healthy. And it's gonna challenge your depth. And so an extra week off at home with your guys
healthy. It's actually an extra 2 weeks off because the way this
2 weeks off. Yeah.
It basically the way the schedule works out is the first round is 2 weeks after the conference title games, and then the second round is 2 weeks after that. So it's the difference between being off 4 weeks or having to play in the middle there.
Yeah, and that's gonna be a big deal in my opinion. I think that's going to honestly probably determine who wins and who loses, like, at the end. Because, like, let's just say you lose an important player in that game, in that first game, like, that could completely cripple your ability, depending on who the player is, to really be competitive in the rest. So I'm intrigued, to say the least, to see how this all ends up playing out and who ends up getting the bye weeks and how that ends up like impacting who wins it all over the course of the first couple of years of this playoff, because four games against tough opponents in a row is really tough to win. Three is hard, but four is really tough.
Yeah, I totally agree. The other thing, the thing I think is we're going to see in the first 2 years is you're going to have the Big 12 and the ACC champs get a bye by default, right? So Utah or Arizona or Colorado or somebody's going to win the Big 12, Kansas State going to win the Big 12, maybe be ranked 10th, but they're going to get a bye, and the you know, third or fourth ranked team in the country is going to have to play in that first round because they finished second in the SEC or second in the Big 12 in the Big 10. And I think that is going to become pretty obvious pretty fast that that's unjust, and I expect that to change in 2026. I expect it'll go, there'll still be automatic bids for those champions, but the buys won't be automatic, right? The buys won't be reserved only for conference champions, but we'll see. We'll see how it plays out.
As it should be, right? Like I can't be convinced that that's like the right way to do it.
Well, it was put together before all the movement, right? So before Texas and Oklahoma and before USC and UCLA. So in the old format, I think it made a little more sense because you didn't have the two, you still had a Power Five when this was put together. You didn't have these two super conferences and you didn't have enough crossplay, right? So when it was announced, it made sense to me that, okay, well, you know, you should get something for winning your conference, and we don't really know which conference is better than the others. It's all kind of speculatory. But in this format, I think it's pretty clear that the number two Big Ten team and the number two SEC team are far more likely than not to be higher quality teams than the winners of the ACC and the Big, certainly the Big 12.
I mean, when you, like, if you asked me to give you a top five right now for next year, there would be three Big Ten teams in the top five and two SEC teams. And if you asked me to give you a top 10, I don't think that there would still be a team outside those two conferences.
Most of the early top 10 lists I've seen put out by the various pundits do not have any Big 12 teams for sure. And most of them don't have an ACC team. They might have a Miami at 9 or 10, or they might have a, depending on who they like, a Florida State at 9 or 10, right? But most of them don't. Most of them are, it's just all SEC and Big 10, maybe a Notre Dame in there late, you know, just depending on whose list you're looking at. The only one I saw that had a Big 12 team was Joel Klatt, who's got Utah at 8, and he says they're too low at 8, which I think that's crazy.
Here, I think they're going to be a lot better. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that they're absolutely, especially now with some of the attrition that's taking place at Arizona, they should be the favorite to win the Big 12. I think pretty handily. Like, I would
almost take them a top 8 team.
No, it doesn't. And that's where I was going to go next is, like, when you look at the roster. So, first of all, Georgia is going to be, like, a real problem for everybody next year. But the five best rosters, in my opinion, coming back in college football next year, I think there's a clear top four. I think it's Georgia, Ohio State, Oregon, and Michigan. And Texas, not Michigan.
Yeah, Texas.
And then Michigan would be fifth. And so, like, if I was rating teams 1 through 5, I would go Georgia 1, Ohio State 2, Oregon 3, Texas 4, Michigan 5.
Yeah. I think that's spot on.
I think that 6 through 10 is a hodgepodge, like, whatever order you like them in, because I don't feel super strong about this, but I'd probably put, like, Penn State, depending on, again, Alabama's roster is very much in flex, but Penn State, Ole Miss.
Bama's going to be in there.
I think Bama probably ends up being in there.
Missouri and Notre Dame.
So Notre Dame would probably be the only non, I mean, they're basically a Big Ten school in waiting. So, Big Ten, Notre Dame in waiting, and then a bunch of Big Ten and SEC schools. And then I think you probably find Utah somewhere around in the early teens, like somewhere between 10 and 15. And I think you probably have at least one ACC team, maybe two, between 10 and 15. That's where USC probably lands. I don't know. I think it'd be kind of a fun exercise to do a tour. I would call it a 25 power rankings. And then we can update it as things change over the course of the offseason.
I totally agree on the power rankings, and I think we'll do that for next episode. The other thing I think is it's going to be really interesting to me to see a couple of things. One, how long does it take? Not that the AP poll matters for much other than it talking and perception, especially in the first half of the season, but do AP pollsters ever adjust their mentality on how they rank teams to be more to consider record less and who you've beaten, who you've played, who you've lost to, like, your quality more, right? Because it still seems like most AP pollsters are still kind of stuck in this, you know, severely outdated model of counting losses. And, you know, that team's 10-2, so they're better than that team that's 9-3. And so I'm curious to see when that changes or if it does. And I'm also curious about the committee protocols, how they're going to change and adapt. Because this year's committee seemed more beholden to win-loss record than I've seen previous committees. And I think if the committee is really just counting losses, then I think we're going to have some seriously misranked teams, and especially in the, like, you know, 8 through 15 range. And that concerns me a little bit. So I'll be interested to see how they evolve.
Yeah, I agree. I'm thinking that, I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see. I think that what's going to end up happening is strength of schedule, like, is going to be weighed very heavily. And, like, the committee, let's be honest, they don't have a consistent approach to this.
No.
So what I think ultimately ends up happening is they have a very strength of schedule heavy approach to it, where they recognize, like, hey, like, Oregon is playing at least two teams in the top 10 next year, and they'll probably end up being a third at some point, or at least a top 15 team in there. Whereas, like, if you're in the Big 12, the odds of you playing a top 15 team, unless you have Utah on your schedule, and if you're Utah, then you're not going to have any, is very low. And so you can't. And I still think ultimately that the Big 12 will end up having like a 3-loss or 2-loss power or champion. So it would be really disappointing to see like a 2 or 3-loss team get a bye in the playoff while a 1 or 2-loss team from the SEC or Big 10 has to go play a game in that first weekend.
Yeah, well, get ready. Get ready. It's going to happen.
You think so?
I think so. I think so. So where is we kind of talking about this, you know, this power rankings, and I agree with you completely. Where would you draw the line on teams that could actually win the title next year in a 12-team playoff? I mean, obviously, you know, name the top five you did. I'd say all of those could potentially win a title. How far down does that go? I'm not talking about making it to the playoffs. I'm not talking about winning a game or two. I'm talking about could win the whole thing. Does that go five deep, 10 deep? I think those top five. You think it's top five?
I think it's those top five, and then potentially, like, we'll see, like, if Riley Leonard takes a huge step forward as a passer, Notre Dame, maybe. But I really think it's those top five. I don't think they have enough firepower Bama? Offensively.
I mean, put Bama in there.
Is DeBoer going to do witchcraft again?
Well, he's got a better roster to do some witchcraft with outside of the quarterback position and probably the
Well, it's kind of interesting because, like, he's got a super young, talented group of quarterbacks now, though, because he just got Austin Ack today, and he already had Julian Sain. I don't know how stoked he is about playing Jalen Milroe for another year, but he might not have to with one of those two young guys. I mean, those are really talented passers. So I think it's to be decided how that ends up playing out there. But I don't think Bama has lost a lot of really important players, like Caleb Downs and Caden Proctor and some of the other defensive backs. Like, I don't know. I think they're going to have a tough time.
Yeah, let's pivot to that because that was the next topic here is, you know, obviously these coaching dominoes falling, and we're seeing at Alabama, right, we're seeing a lot of guys hit the portal. I think it's in double digits now, you know, some five stars, some also several decommitments from the 2025 class and beyond, which is, you know, Saban was there 17 years. Like, expecting any coach to come in and hold everything together is probably not realistic, but, you know, particularly in DeBoer's case, because I think, you know, for the reasons we've talked about, it'll be interesting to see how that roster shakes out over the coming months as well. And he's bringing over a couple guys from Alabama or from Washington with him, I think. But I don't know, man. We're hearing a lot that Alabama doesn't have the NIL resources, and kids have been playing there for discounts to play for Saban. And what do you think? Is Bama going to come back to the? I mean, they've already come back to the pack a bit. But do they win a title in the next 3 years?
I would bet no. But it doesn't mean that I don't think that Bama's, like, I think whatever NIL issues they have, whatever they've been able to get away with, like, I don't think that that fan base and those boosters are going to sit back and allow that to be a continual issue. I think that they'll get their NIL house in order, and ultimately they'll end up being probably a perennial top 10 team, but DeBoer has to prove quite a bit to me as a recruiter in order to be a surefire national champion. Because, like, here's the deal. You're a good coach, but Kirby right down the street is a really good coach. Hugh Freeze right down the street is a really good coach. And they're going to out-recruit you most likely. So,
hey, all. Thanks for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning, this rest of the episode unfortunately got cut off and lost, and we do not have any way to recover it. So apologies for that. We hope you did enjoy this episode. We will be back with Justin next week to talk about recruiting, talk about coaching, talk about roster management, talk about whatever's relevant in college football, and particularly in regards to the Oregon Ducks. Once again, thank you all for listening. Follow us on Twitter @QB11SD, @DouglasTS, and @QB11Show. Thank you very much.